Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for December 2011. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. On November 2, 2011, the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom handed down its first patent case since it took over from the House of Lords. The case involved Human Genome Sciences, Inc. and Eli Lilly, and decided when a protein that has been designed but never tested has industrial applicability, one of the criteria for patentable subject matter under the European Patent Convention. Gareth Morgan is a partner at Winston & Strawn's London, England office. In addition to being called to the bar of England and Wales, Gareth has a PhD in molecular biology and, not surprisingly, focuses his practice on patents in the life science and healthcare sectors. I spoke with Dr. Morgan from his office in London, England. Hello, Gareth.
Hello there, Don.
I understand that the recent decision of the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom in the Human Genome Sciences against Eli Lilly case has caused quite a stir in terms of patentability of proteins. Could you explain at sort of the 40,000-foot level what the case is about?
Certainly. The two litigants in the case, Human Genome Sciences and Eli Lilly, were really arguing over the rights to antibodies to a particular protein that is important in the immune system. And there was a commercial reason for that, obviously. GSK have done a deal with Human Genome Sciences, and they currently have a product that's very close to market, and Eli Lilly is following very close behind. So this patent battle obviously has fairly large commercial implications for the two companies and their monoclonal antibody products. In relation to the legal issues that were actually at stake, the invention itself was a gene-based invention. So Human Genome Sciences were the first people to dig out a new gene sequence to a protein that was called neutrokine alpha. Now, the new gene itself was found using techniques that are known as bioinformatics, which is essentially a database searching program. Once they had actually found the new sequence, they plugged that into a database of known sequences and then fished out a couple of comparators that allowed them to make some predictions as to what their new gene might actually do. The patent itself was a little short on additional information as to what the gene might do. There was some tissue expression information in there, so charting where in the body this particular gene was actually expressed. But in reality, the membership of a superfamily of proteins really held the key to Human Genome Sciences being able to patent this particular product. At first instance in the UK, Eli Lilly brought a wide-ranging attack against the patent, and the judge at first instance, Mr. Justice Kitchen, who's a very experienced patents court judge, now a Lord Justice in our Court of Appeal, held the patent to be invalid for lack of industrial applicability, lack of inventive step, and also as being insufficient. So it was a pretty resounding win for Eli Lilly at first instance. In the Court of Appeal, the Court of Appeal only looked at industrial applicability and upheld the judge's decision on that score. And then that went to the Supreme Court, which is the decision you've been talking about, and the Supreme Court actually reversed both the lower courts. So the big question in the Supreme Court was, what standard should the UK courts be applying when looking at whether or not an invention has industrial applicability?
In North America, we're used to patents being granted for inventions that are new, useful, and inventive. Can you tell me what's the relationship between useful or the utility requirement that we have in North America and this, what I understand, EPC Article 52 says that it must be susceptible to industrial application?
I think it's a useful comparison because certainly utility is the nearest North American comparator to the requirement for industrial applicability that's found in the European Patent Convention. However, the judge at first instance did take into account the U.S. case law on utility. That possibly really did count against him, because one point that Lord Neuberger made in the Supreme Court decision was that the way in which the U.S. law is framed and the way in which the case law has developed in the U.S. Doesn't necessarily give a very good guidance as to how the specific Article 52 in the European Patent Convention, should actually be interpreted. So, in fact, the Supreme Court has held that the two concepts are really different.
Am I correct that the protein in question in this case was designed but never made? And could you perhaps explain for a non-protein chemist the nature of the development of this protein?
I can. And the key to the invention, really, the core, was the bioinformatic database searching and the discovery that that this new protein was actually a member of what is called the TNF superfamily, tumor necrosis factor superfamily. Now, all of these proteins they have some use in the immune system as immunomodulators of B cells or T cells, and so, you know, clearly the membership of the superfamily did so Human Genome Sciences claim. Suggest a use for the protein itself, neutrokine alpha, and then agonists to that protein, which could eventually turn into pharmaceutical products. And by agonists, I mean things that affected the activity of the new protein, most notably monoclonal antibodies that might bind to it and either stimulate or inhibit its activity. So, really, the Human Genome Sciences invention was the very first step along the road to getting new pharmaceutical products. And this is why the invention and this decision have attracted so much attention. It's because the patent in question is what in the biotech industry you would describe as a target patent. So what it does is describe a new gene, a new protein. It does give you the sequence of the protein, but obviously, you know, not an awful lot more in relation to finding out what the protein does, other than that it's a member of this superfamily, which has a very, very broad range of possible activities and uses. Now, in order to get from that stage to a pharmaceutical product is actually a pretty long and tortuous process, and that is going to be examined in a lot more detail when the case goes back to the Court of Appeal now to hear the case on inventive step and sufficiency in particular.
So, although this molecule is brand new, it has the same or similar structure or characteristics as a broader, as you described it, a superfamily of proteins. And as a result, you can make certain assumptions as to how it's going to behave. Is that right?
That's right. In a number of circumstances, and certainly that's the way that the Technical Boards of Appeal at the European Patent Office have proceeded with jurisprudence in this particular area of gene-based inventions. You find a string of cases in which the membership of a superfamily has actually been critical to an invention being held to have or to lack industrial applicability. So certainly the Technical Boards of Appeal at the European Patent Office place a very great deal of stock on this membership of a superfamily. Now, obviously, not all superfamilies are equal, and some superfamilies will provide a pretty tight definition of potential uses for a new member, because most of the members have one particular function in one particular tissue, maybe in the body. Certainly others, and the TNF family is one of those, has an enormous range of activities, and part of the controversy here was whether the membership of the TNF superfamily really told the skilled person anything about the uses that that agonists to neutrokine alpha could actually be put. And I think therein lies the controversial element in this case.
Let's before we get into what this particular TNF was expected to do, talk about what the court was doing in this particular case. And as I read the judgment, the court said that the real issue in the case was whether or not the lower court decisions had followed the principles laid down by the board's jurisprudence. And maybe if you could explain the relationship between decisions made by the EPO and its enlarged boards of appeal and the UK courts.
Yeah, absolutely. The UK courts are certainly not bound in any way to follow the boards of appeal of the European Patent Office, whether it be the enlarged boards of appeal, which are the second appellate layer, or the technical boards of appeal, which are the first appellate layer. In fact, the UK now, for the last two decades, at the highest level in the House of Lords, has really set out the desirability of following certainly the enlarged boards of appeal of the European Patent Office and latterly principles that have been developed through technical boards of appeal jurisprudence as well. And that has come down through a line of House of Lords cases. And the House of Lords is obviously the predecessor to the UK Supreme Court. So although not technically binding on UK courts, if the same evidence and the same arguments have been played out in the technical boards of appeal, then following the Human Genome Sciences case, I think in the future it's going to be difficult to persuade the UK courts to actually deviate from what the technical boards of appeal have done, as provided you can pin it to some principle which has come out of the technical boards of appeal case law.
Let's talk about the strategy then in terms of running a case where it's being heard both by the Board of Appeal or the UK, potentially the UK court. Would a party be better off putting all their evidence in the first instance for the technical board of appeal and hoping for the best, or would they be wiser to wait and rely on the discovery and cross-examination of expert forum that is found in a UK case, or UK court rather?
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, really, Dom. The UK civil court procedure is much more similar to North American court procedure, where trials of a couple of days, if not a couple of weeks, and extensive cross-examination of the fact and experts' evidence that's been put in issue in the case is actually permitted. The technical boards of appeal really aren't as well set up as a fact-finding body and as an adversarial tribunal as are the UK courts. So I think parties would be well advised that even though there is a clear advantage to winning a case at the European Patent Office, because the patent would either be upheld or revoked for the entire European patent organisation, there has to be some thought given now to running fact-heavy arguments, so insufficiency-type arguments, prior use type arguments at the technical boards of appeal, when you may be better to keep your powder dry and run those arguments in a tribunal where you know that you're probably going to get a better crack of the whip and be able to cross-examine the other side's witnesses in the live court case.
What can you tell us about the way this case was handled in terms of the factual evidence and the findings made by the judge who had the opportunity to see the expert witnesses give testimony?
Well, at first instance, the judge heard extensive evidence over a number of weeks, in fact, as to the potential uses in particular of the TNF superfamily. The counsel who appeared to Lilly in the Supreme Court case spoke at an event in London last night, and certainly one point that they think that the Supreme Court did not give sufficient weight to was the fact that the judge did have this opportunity to assess in great detail the evidence as to what the skilled person would have understood from membership of the TNF superfamily as at the filing date of this patent. And really, the judge came to the conclusion that it wouldn't have given them much help. He also, during cross-examination, made some adverse findings about the evidence that was given by the Human Genome Sciences expert. And really, you know, when you try to compare and contrast the UK lower court's decisions with the Technical Board of Appeal, that this is quite an important comparator, that the UK court heard extensive cross-examination, and Mr. Justice Kitchen, as he then was, made some adverse inferences on the Human Genome Sciences experts' evidence, whereas the Technical Board of Appeal in the EPO didn't have the benefit of any of that. So, really, in the context of that, it is quite a significant thing for the Supreme Court to do, to overturn the lower court's decisions, claiming that it was based on an incorrect application of principles, and also made the statement that it was that the same evidence was before the two courts, because I don't believe it was. The extensive cross-examination and the findings that the UK High Court made in relation to what skilled person would take from TNF as superfamily membership, I think were fact-based and not principle-based. So I believe that the UK Supreme Court has probably gone too far in its desire to align the UK with the EPO in this respect, and I think it was a wrong decision.
One of the things that the court referred to was some arguments that were made by the Bioindustry Association and about the threshold of development that was necessary before a patent application could be filed, and how much work had to be done before it was enough to support a patent application. Could you discuss that argument and the circumstances of how that fit into this case?
It's actually quite a new process for us. I think in North America, you're used to the idea of sort of amicus curiae briefs to support high-level appellate cases. The procedure now is that you can actually intervene and present a submission to the Supreme Court, despite the fact that you weren't actually a party to the proceedings at the lower court levels, and that's what the UK Bioindustry Association did. And the UK Bioindustry Association is an organisation that represents the UK biotech industry. So clearly, its members had an interest in the case, and I have to set out disclose a conflict, if you like, before going any further, because I do sit on their IP advisory committee. And it was the IP advisory committee that put an awful lot of work into crafting the submissions that were actually put into the Supreme Court case. Now, what was certainly the message that the Bioindustry Association wanted to convey to the Supreme Court really was not one of if you bar patent, if you knock out the Human Genome Sciences patent in this area, it would be disastrous for UK biotech, because we won't be able to get patents, and that will mean we won't be able to get investment. But really, it was a call for clarity in the law, the fact that everybody wants a level playing field, and the Supreme Court recognised this, that in Bioindustry Association submissions, not only was there a plea to recognise that the biotech industry does live on patents that can then be used to generate further investment and so drive R&D. But also that there is a flip side to that as well, that the patents shouldn't be granted to give the patentee what familiar North American term, a hunting license over a particular area that is unjustified. So there has to be a certain level of work and information and technical contribution that's provided by the patentee before the monopoly is granted. So the Bioindustry Association really was was putting forward a plea on the Supreme Court to actually clarify the law in this area and make sure that its members simply knew with rules it was playing they're playing to in this area.
The court laid out some general principles in the case concerning industrial applicability and what was necessary or what the threshold was. And I found some of the terminology of that odd from a Canadian or North American perspective, because it seemed to be saying that you can't be speculative on the one hand, but an educated guess that this thing is going to have industrial applicability was enough. And that struck me as odd from a North American perspective, and I suppose that would be struck probably odd from the lower UK court judges' perspective as well. I wonder if you could comment on the threshold that is now laid out by this particular case for industrial applicability.
Well, Don, again, I think you're absolutely right that there is a distinct contradiction there between the principles that are laid out in the judgment, where it's stated that mere speculative use will not suffice. But on the other hand, an educated guess can suffice. And the Supreme Court really went at pains to indicate that certainly in the expert evidence as well, there's some confusion in the expert evidence as to what was an educated guess and what was speculation. And it's a very, very fine dividing line between the two, and when you're talking about whether something actually qualifies for patentability or not. I think the way that the court approached the technical board jurisprudence in this area possibly raises a real danger, because the way that the boards have gone in the gene-based invention area has been really to use this membership of a superfamily as being a bit of a panacea for both industrial applicability and, to a certain extent, to inventive step. And I'd like to draw out certainly another danger from the statement of principles that the UK Supreme Court has set out, where they use the word plausible to describe the claimed use, which would actually qualify a patent for or satisfy the industrial applicability criteria for patentability. Now, this word plausible, it's beginning to enter into the jurisprudence and the analysis of very many articles of the EPC. It comes into the technical board jurisprudence in the analysis of inventive step and Article 54, and also insufficiency in Article 83. I think it's the former that causes the most concern for me as a patent lawyer, though, because if this idea of plausibility is coming into industrial applicability, that there's a real danger that effectively satisfying what is a relatively low hurdle, and it's always meant to be a relatively low hurdle for industrial applicability in some way, then contaminates any analysis of an inventive step. Because if certainly a plausible use has been put forward for the invention, then it's very difficult to argue that if you're formulating the problem, which is the way that the EPO likes to analyze inventive step, formulating a problem with reference to, for example, membership of a superfamily, then your answer to industrial applicability more or less then taints your analysis of inventive step. And I'll give you the example. If you hold the fact that Neutropan Alpha is a member of the TNF superfamily as being sufficient plausible evidence for industrial applicability, then really you shouldn't be formulating the problem of the patent as being the provision of a further member of the TNF superfamily, because it becomes a little bit circular. The thought that all you need is a bioinformatics database search and a couple of hits on a superfamily, and hey presto, you've got a patent that satisfies industrial applicability and inventive step is quite crazy.
I'm hearing echoes in the judgment of what we recently went through in Canada was whether or not the obvious to try or worth a try test was a proper test for obviousness in Canada, and we followed the decision of Saint-Gobain in England that said that in order for something to be obvious, it had to be more or less self-evident it ought to work. And the echo I'm hearing in this particular case is that either an educated guess or it's likely or it's in effect worth an industrial try to pursue the document further, compound further rather, strikes me as oddly disharmonic, if you will, with where inventiveness has gone. In terms of it needs to be predictable that this thing is going to work, as opposed to merely an educated guess or a plausible use for it.
Yes, I follow your reasoning, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, Connor and Angie Tech, for example, in the House of Lords, the House of Lords held there that all that it was a required of a patentee was that they presented a solution to a problem that was plausible. You know, the fact that there wasn't an awful lot of laboratory work and experimentation and proof of the claimed invention in the Angiotech patent didn't necessarily matter for the purposes of assessing the inventive step in that patent for patentability purposes. Yet you flip the argument, and patent challengers tend to be getting a bit more of a hard time when they're putting forward obvious to try arguments, where the hurdle for them to pass seems to be higher than for a patentee. So it could be the start of a trend that we see in the UK towards a much more patentee-friendly jurisdiction. I mean, the UK courts have always been regarded as being relatively patentee-unfriendly, which I don't think is a fair statement to make. I mean, the truth is that as a fairly intensive process for looking at the validity of patents, patent challengers have come to realise that if a patent is going to go down in Europe, then the UK is a good place to start, because that's where any cracks in the patent will actually be exposed. So, you know, part of it is that patent revocation claimants have long recognised the UK as a good jurisdiction for attacking weak patents. So it's a bit self-serving in that respect. But it could be that we are beginning to see more of EPO thinking coming into the UK.
In this particular case, you were dealing with a protein that was a member of this superfamily, and it gained industrial applicability, much like you might have guilty by association. In this case, it had industrial applicability by association because the rest of the superfamily had at least some consistent characteristics right across the family, and therefore a prediction could be made about this member of the family. I wonder if you could explain whether or not you think this type of case law is limited to proteins that are members of superfamilies, or is there a much broader implication here in terms of the threshold for industrial applicability amongst different kinds of inventions?
Again, an interesting point, because the superfamily concept in protein chemistry, it's not really unique to biotechnology. I mean, certainly you can think of a whole manner of chemical families, for example, that have related structures, and that you might consider that perhaps producing a new chemical within that particular family may actually then confer some sort of industrial applicability and or inventive step on it without having to prove that it actually does anything. It's certainly a dangerous line to go down, and maybe the real answer is that this decision is limited to gene-based inventions and the unique sort of questions that you tend to be asking, because the gene obviously is the starting point for the invention, yet the gene really doesn't do anything. The gene is only a step on the way to producing a protein. The protein is a bit more interesting. Even so, it is compounds that actually act on the protein and modulate the protein's activity that are usually the interesting compounds that the inventors will be looking for. So maybe the recognition that a gene is a very long way away from a useful and commercially important product, maybe that is influencing the Boards of Appeal to a certain extent. But we'll have to look what happens on the sufficiency, for example, of the Bridgetree claims, because if patents like this are being granted and the Bridgetree claims to pharmaceutical products are then being upheld, well, it does seem like a pretty easy way to get a monopoly on what could be an incredibly lucrative area of research.
So what would you say are the key takeaways from this decision?
Well, say if I was an inventor with a gene-based patent, I would take heart. I would be scouring databases to find any sort of association with known proteins if my patent was a little light on experimental evidence. Certainly, if I was drafting a gene-based patent now, the decision in the UK Supreme Court and in the Technical Board of Appeal didn't, although they criticised the drafting of the patent as throwing in the kitchen sink and including contradictory uses for nucleotide alpha, ultimately that was held not to be a problem. So I guess the message that patentees and patent attorneys should take out of this is that you shouldn't hold back when you're drafting these sorts of patents. You need to get everything in, and then at a later date, you can make good one or two of the claimed uses through post-published evidence, because that actually came into the case as well. Post-published evidence is good to confirm a suggested use of the invented protein, but only if that invented use is actually contained in the patent. So, you know, it's bizarre that the decisions of both the Technical Board and the UK Supreme Court seem to be encouraging patentees to speculate and fill their patents full of, well, puff, really.
I suppose they'd be saying this may be used for anything under the sun, and as you say, if post-patent application evidence shows that it was useful for that, then, as you said, that buttresses the industrial applicability argument that was made before. So we may see a change in the way patents are drafted to not necessarily promise everything, but promise that this may have that result. Is that fair?
I think that's completely fair, because when you have the court laying out general principles that come out of TBA jurisprudence, which include a statement that educated guesses can suffice within patents, then that is only encouraging patent attorneys and applicants to speculate.
It creates an interesting conundrum for applicants who are also applying in jurisdictions such as Canada that require a much more dedicated basis of a foundation of data and a sound prediction before an educated guess can be made as to what the thing can be used for. I don't envy patent drafters.
No, not at all. Neither do I. That's why I much prefer to be at the litigation end of the patent life cycle rather than the conception.
I'll second that as a litigator. Thank you very much for these insights, Gareth.
You're welcome, Don.
Gareth Morgan is a partner at Winston & Strawn in London, England. For further information on the Human Genome Sciences case and other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.